Okay, are we ready? Metamorphic. I couldn't remember that third category of rock. Igneous, sedimentary. Well, yeah, it starts out igneous, sedimentary, metamorphic. Granite is a metamorphic. It's like refried beans. Second time around. You know, all the sand of the seashore used to be mountains at one time. Now, how long do you suppose it took to grind all the sand of the seashore? You know, long time. This earth is very old. Boy, it's just hard to understand, though, that even from an evolutionary point of view, modern man has only been here 50,000 years or 100,000 years. Now, it's a little longer than theologians would say, you know, Genesis was. They would put it back at, you know, maybe 6,000, or some would say like 8 to 10. All right, 10 times that, 100,000 is nothing. What is 100,000 years in 5.5 billion? Actually, 4.5 billion for the earth. 4.5 billion, 100,000. It's like, wow, it's nothing. You know, if it's the hours on a clock, you know, it's like 1 second before midnight. Man appeared, and that's what's so amazing. He did just appear, and everybody knows it. This idea that you can link him back and back is nonsense, and most real scientists know it's nonsense. Modern man just showed up. 50 to 100,000 years ago, there was no modern Homo sapien men. And boom, there they were. Where did they come from? Where did they come from? You know? I mean, the dinosaurs, they figured they lived from 165 million years ago to 50 million years ago. 115 million years. Dinosaurs existed. Mankind? A couple of thousand. Where did he come from? Boom! There's modern man. Where is he over? He's not there. You got all these other animals, and then you get back to, you know, the lizards and the dinosaurs. There's no men. Well, we'll talk about that next year. All right, let's go through now page 17 in your notes. It says at the top there that, you know, the dark and middle ages, there was a period where the only scriptures available except the Hebrew and Greek, which, you know, not many people on planet Earth could read Hebrew or Greek, was Latin. And it's interesting that Jerome supposedly translated the Vulgate in 382, okay? And Wycliffe translated the first English Bible in 1382. Exactly 1,000 years. Isn't that interesting? How did that ever come about? Exactly 1,000 years to the year. Now, Wycliffe, I mean, you got to give the man credit. I mean, he's the first man to venture out and make an English Bible, and it was frowned upon, you know. If you notice the bottom of that paragraph there under Wycliffe's picture says, the Pope was so infuriated by his teachings and his translation of the Bible in English that 44 years after Wycliffe had died, he ordered his bones dug up, crushed, and scattered in a river. I mean, just out of sheer hatred. This is the Pope. He's sending a Peter, supposedly. I don't think so. Though it's amazing, Wycliffe, he is handwritten. The Bible is handwritten. Now, he didn't write them all. I'm sure he wrote one, and then there were scribes, and they looked at that, and they, you know, they made copies. But how many have ever seen a printed page of a Wycliffe Bible. Anybody? One. Okay. It is so beautiful and so flawless, it looks like print. It looks like it was printed on a printing press. That's how good it is. And it's done by hand. Absolutely mind-boggling. But they didn't have television and all that stuff because you tracked them. You know, they sat there in the noonday sun, you know, and whatever. There were several additions. I think they all made corrections because these men were scholars and students of the scriptures, and they would say, oh, you know, I got to change that verse, you know, and then every 5 or 10 years or whatever, they'd come out with a new edition because they were very slowly produced, very easy to just, even when printing came out, you just change a few lines of type, you know, and it's a new edition. We made some corrections, made some improvements, and so on. So the first one was 1384, and 26 years later, they had a 1410 edition. And this site, greatsite.com, they have one for sale. You can buy it. Wycliffe handwritten 1410 Bible. It's $2,750,000. That's probably a good bargain. I don't know. $2,750,000. You can buy a Wycliffe 1410 edition. Okay, so this was the first Bible translated into the English language, but it was translated from the Latin Vulgate. Okay, so it was just but we can't poo-poo the Vulgate completely. I mean, the Vulgate was a pretty good translation overall. And Jerome's original Vulgate did not have all these errors of ever, ever, never, never land nonsense, you know. They had these Latin words, eternus and eternum, but it didn't mean eternity like the word does today. It meant an age. It was just a Latin version. In fact, Alexander Thompson, the Scottish theologian he didn't die that long ago, about 60 years ago he died. But he traces eternity back to eternus and eternum, the Latin eternus and eternum, and he traces it right back to the Greek aion. The word eternity comes from the Greek word aion, age. It absolutely does. And it never, ever meant endless time. It was Justinian in about 558 or so A.D. Justinian, who started reasoning, you know, and you know what the Bible says about human reasoning. He said, well, if the saved saints never die, then the wicked never die either. So the scripture doesn't say that, but you see. So when it says that we're going to receive aeonian life, then the wicked must receive aeonian judgment. And since we know aeonian life never ends, judgment must never end. But he knew that the word aeonian didn't mean endless. So he tacked the word onto it. Endless aeonian. There you go. Now we solved the problem. The saints receive endless aeonian life, and the wicked receive endless aeonian punishment. By the very fact that he had to interject a word that wasn't there, proves conclusively that aeonius never meant endless. You don't put the word endless in front of the word endless. You don't have endless, endless life. You see? But he came up with this endless aeonian. Why? Because because aeonian doesn't mean endless, and he wanted it to be endless, so he put endless on. Endless aeonian. Endless ages. It's heresy. It's not in the Scriptures. It's heresy. And Jerome used the word eternum, eternus, but it never meant endless. I mean, it was like in the 6th century before somebody started talking about endless aeonian, which is a you know, just a fabrication. Okay, so there we have the first English Bible. Then one of Wycliffe's followers, John Huss, he promoted Wycliffe's ideas. I mean, Wycliffe knew that the church was not following the Scriptures. I mean, they learned Hebrew and Greek. And that's an interesting story, how they learned it too. It was because people from the Byzantine, I mean, there were a lot of scholars in the Byzantine Empire, and, you know, there was a period where they had to run for their lives, and some of them fled into northwestern Europe, and they brought this knowledge of ancient languages with them, you know. But it wasn't until, oh, I don't know, it wasn't like to like 1350 or something before Oxford University. I think it was Oxford first, maybe Cambridge, but Oxford, I believe, offered a course in Greek. I mean, everybody says Greek to me, you know, and then people start learning Greek. But it was for all practical, even Latin was not known in Europe that well. The only people who could read a Bible were theologians and scholars. Nobody out in the farm, or shoemakers or farmers, they couldn't read. They didn't know Latin. Well, the church people wanted it that way. You know, they're in total control and charge of these people's, not only their physical lives here and now, but their eternal destiny. Everybody thought it was in the hands of these theologians, you know. How many of you ever read Chaucer's Canterbury Tales? Okay, Gene read it. Oh, Gene put out these papers on the end of the rows with an outline from Dr. Martin's book, you know. I had not seen it, but it's pretty similar to what I did. But then I could see why that would be, because I took Dr. Martin's classes. I have an old outline of Dr. Martin's notes on canonization, but he got his doctorate on the study of canonization of the Scriptures, and he wrote, I don't know, like a 1,000-page thesis, but I've never read it or seen it. A couple weeks ago, I thought, you know, I bet I could get a copy of that. But I thought, no, it's too late. You know, it's too late. I would have needed to start that months ago. But I bet I could. I mean, it's got to be out at the foundation. There's got to be a copy of it someplace. I probably could get a copy. Maybe I'll check into that. Because eventually that stuff will just be gone. You know, it'll be gone. Nobody knows whatever happened to it. But it's interesting now. Here come, you know, they dug up Wycliffe's bones, and Huss was a protege, and they burned him at the stake. Okay, page 18. All right, we'll get into printing here. Johann Gutenberg invented the printing press somewhere around 1450, and the first thing, I'm sure they made a few experimental things on something, you know, probably Gutenberg name and address or something. But the first major thing that they published on the printing press was what you see on your cover, that very Bible right there. That's the first thing came off the first printing press in the world, the Gutenberg Bible. What amazes me is they think it was around 185 copies were made, and 48 of them are still around. Some of them are just partial pages missing, like my old German Bible, but somewhere between 3 and 10 copies are considered perfect condition. No missing pages, you know, cover still attached. You know, that's amazing. That's 562 years ago. That's a long time to have a book around and still be in perfect condition. Lanier, you can read about him. That last sentence is interesting. It says, yet the church threatened to kill anyone who read Scripture in any language other than Latin, though Latin was not an original language of the Bible. You know, are we allowed to read it in Greek? No, just Latin. Only Latin. Okay. Let's go next to Erasmus. Now, Erasmus, you know, he's a key person in how all our modern and our English Bibles came about, because he compiled these Greek manuscripts. I think he had like six of them, six different Greek manuscripts, and then he, where they get this term textus receptus, is he made a compilation, I think, of the six manuscripts. These were Byzantine texts. I mean, they were in Greek, but they came out of the Byzantine Empire. You all know what the Byzantine means? Byzantine was like the Eastern Empire after Rome fell, okay? The Eastern Empire, Turkey, Constantinople, that was the, or Istanbul, same city. That was the center of the Byzantine Empire, whereas Rome and northern Africa, Alexander and those places, where it was the seat of learning and libraries and for the western part of the empire. So Erasmus was a Swiss scholar, and they said he was a very brilliant man, just absolute genius. And he had, however, maybe through trade, learned about, anyway, he got six Byzantine Greek manuscripts of the New Testament, and he compiled a work where he put the best representation of the Greek on one side of a page and Latin on the other. Okay? So, the first person to use that as a basis, you see, you understand, the Latin Vulgate for 1,000 years, remember? Jerome was commissioned to make a decent revision of all these Latin scriptures that were kind of corrupted, and he came up with the Vulgate, a pretty good work. Now that Vulgate went through its own evolution. It isn't like we had the Vulgate for 1,000 years. No. We had the original Vulgate, you know, 382, 482, 5, but then 582, 682, they start making revisions of that. Okay? And that's where these words start evolving, you know, and they start interjecting other words and other meanings and so on and so forth. Now, Wycliffe, the first English translation, 1382, 1,000 years from the original Vulgate, it's sometimes called the English Vulgate, because his translation is from the Vulgate, only into English. Okay? Now, okay, back in the early 1400s, okay, Wycliffe was 382, almost up to the year 1400, but then in the early 1400s, the Germans were translating German Bibles from the Vulgate. Okay? I mean, the Vulgate was the source of everything from the Vulgate. Then we come up to, let's see, what date we have here for Erasmus? Around 1516, I think, is the date we have here. And he put together from these six Greek manuscripts, and then apparently they were not all complete, but between them all he got a complete, you know, manuscript, and he did this parallel thing with the Greek and the Latin, because Latin really was the scholarly language in Europe, no matter where you lived. If you were a scholar, a teacher, an educator, and you lived in Switzerland, you spoke Latin. If you lived in Germany, you spoke Latin. If you lived in England, you spoke Latin. Listen, when the 50 men that King James selected to revise the bishop's Bible into the King James Version, he picked 50 men. I think four of them didn't show up or whatever, or six of them. There was 54, 56 or what actually did the work. But, you know, they're working on the English Bible, right? Talking in Latin. All it says, they had, like, I don't know, ten companies, groups or committees. They would work, one worked on, you know, the Pentateuch, one worked on Ezra, Nehemiah, or Joshua, Judges, one worked on the Megillah, one worked on a couple of the major prophets, you know, all the way down to Revelation. And then they would periodically get together and see how they were all doing, see if they were learning something that would benefit each other and what they were doing. And all the discussions were always in Latin. It's kind of ironical, isn't it? They're living in English-speaking world, translating a new English Bible, and are all speaking Latin. It just shows how powerful that language was and how prominent it had to do with the translation of the Scriptures. Okay, but now, 60 years before King James came out, Luther is putting together a German Bible. But he's not going to translate this one from the Latin. He uses Erasmus' parallel of the Greek and the Latin, and he puts that in the German. So this is the first European, the first European Bible in a European language that's translated from the original language. Okay? Martin Luther's Bible. Now, next we have William Tyndale, in the middle of page 19. And this is the real kingpin to all translations. It is Tyndale that put this unique, rhythmic, poetic flow to what we call the King James Bible, you know? I mean, it doesn't have to come out quite that way. You can translate it, you know, using all the words, proper idioms. You know, I read you the 23rd Psalm from the Concordance. It was just very awkward, you know? Your club and your rod, they comfort me. You know? I mean, your club and your staff, you know. My cup is satiated instead of my cup runneth over. You know, it was just very awkward, you know, choppy, awkward, kind of guttural words, you know. But the English just, I mean, the King just flows. But it's not King James, it's Tyndale. It's all Tyndale. And so Tyndale went to Germany because they wouldn't allow anybody to print German Bibles, I mean English Bibles in England. You know, they were deaf against that. And he worked with with Martin Luther, and it was only like 2 years earlier that Martin Luther came out with his, earlier, and now Tyndale wants to do it, and so fine, they work together and use the same thing. Erasmus's compilation of a half a dozen Byzantine Greek texts with the Latin next to it, and that's what they used. They produced rather quickly, and you could see where they could produce it now rather quickly, because Martin Luther had just worked for years on his, see? And Tyndale, he knew Greek and everything, see? So then, I could see where on almost every verse, you know, Martin Luther would say, well, yeah, this, that, and the other thing. And he said, they just instantly see it. They wouldn't have to do this second independent study. And within 1 year, just 1 year, he had translated from the Greek and the Latin. I mean, they compared them both because they knew both languages. But at least they had the original Greek manuscripts now. He produced his Bible. And okay, well, we got Martin Luther coming back in here again. Okay, he produced the first complete Bible in 1534. And King James, is almost a century later, 1611. All right, so then Tyndale, he does his Bible, and the New Testament was in 1525, 1526 that year. Martin Luther had done the New Testament first too, the New Testament, then the Old, and so Tyndale then he did the New Testament and started to work on the Old Testament and didn't finish it. The King of England, of course, was death on Tyndale's version. He would have merchants buy up the ships, buy up all the versions, and then he would burn them. Just burn them. Well, but Tyndale kept getting the money for him, so he had money to keep printing more and more. And eventually, they won out. But boy, you couldn't even get caught with one of these Bibles, let alone preaching from it, That's the iron fist that the religion had on them. So they tried to discredit and said it was really a corrupt version, had thousands of errors in it, and so on and so forth, which is really pretty ridiculous, because not too many years later, the same kings and the same country and the same scholars who criticized this thing are now using it as the primary version to make the King James Bible. There's a little bit there in the middle of the page, and page 20, read all of that, talks about why the church was so frantic about people getting the Bible in their own language, Where I guess it was Tyndale said, he told one theologian once, he said, if I get my Bible out there, he said, the plowboys are going to know as much about Scripture as you do, Well, they feared that because the church had this iron fist, this iron hand rule over the people. They were selling indulgences and all things like that. Collecting tithes, selling indulgences, purgatory. They're just teaching a purgatory. But if you paid the church so much, it gets you out of purgatory. You buy your way out. Now, I mentioned Canterbury Tales. Nobody has read Canterbury Tales. Well, you ought to read it, because he talks like I do, He talks. It talks about these different priests in the church, and how they just were blatantly corrupt, And they just admit it. They said, "Hey, you know, this is a living. This is what I do for a living. You know, I sell trinkets. I sell religious junk to the people, and that's how I make a living." And they freely admitted they had a wench. Yeah. You know, like they say, the sailor has a girl in every port, you know. They had a wench in every town. These priests, they just freely admitted it, you know. And you say, well, that was Chaucer, just, you know, he had an axe to grind or what. No, I think it was, you know, I mean, this is a poetic book. It's very long. But no, it's history. it's history. I mean, it was just that corrupt. But you ought to read Canterbury Tales. I mean, it's... of course, you can't read the original. It was written back in like 1400s or 1300s, maybe 1300 or 1400s. But that old English, did you ever see English from the 1300s, 1400s, anybody? Like Joe did again. Like Beowulf or something?
No, I saw the old images from the same museum.
Yeah. But it looks like German.
Yeah.
Sounds like German.
Yeah.
If I were to read to you old English, you'd think I was speaking German or Dutch.
You can't read it or make sense out of it. That'd be very laborious.
I can catch some words because I know a little bit of German. And it's interesting to me, though. To me, Dutch sounds just like German. And yet my wife cannot understand Dutch. I said, honey, it's the same language. I mean, it sounded the same. She said, they might sound the same, but they're not the same language. Oh, she knows what they're talking about. I mean, you know, like bread is brot, and maybe in Dutch it's brot, or so, you know, and some of them are like pretty simple, but then other words, totally different. She said, the words are just totally different. So, but Old English sounds like German. Just sounds like German. I mean, whether you can pronounce the words properly or not, it just sounds like German. After we take a break, probably we'll the next section we'll get into the Gothic version, you know, and I mean with some pretty many years ago I learned about that Gothic version, but there was a European version of the Bible back in the 300s. Not the 1300s, the 300s. Yes, there was. We'll talk about that when we come to just the chronological dates in a few more pages. Okay. let's see. There's only two known copies of his 1525 first edition. Okay, now Miles Coverdale. Now we come to Miles Coverdale. Miles Coverdale was a man, likewise, who was was kind of an early reformer, and a friend of Tyndale, and Coverdale. Tyndale started to do the Old Testament. He finished the New Testament, printed it, and started to do the whole Bible, you know, with the Old Testament too, but didn't finish it. They killed him. But Coverdale finished it, see? So there's a little bit of Coverdale in Tyndale's complete Bible, all right? Then we have John Rogers, first English Bible translated from the original language in the Hebrew and Greek. Called the Thomas Bible. Now it says it remains most commonly known as the Matthew Tyndale Bible. Then down there, Thomas Cranmer, Archbishop of Canterbury, hired Coverdale to at the behest of the king to publish the Great Bible. See how they all overlap? We had Martin and working with him, Tyndale, and then finishing Tyndale with Coverdale, and then Coverdale, Matthew Tyndale's Bible, John Rogers, and then you got Kramer, who hired Coverdale to make an official copy for the king. It became the first English Bible authorized for public use. In other words, now they pretty much knew there's no keeping the English Bible out of the people's hand. They're going to get them. I mean, they got the presses over there in Germany. If we can't print them here in England, they're going to print them over there, and they're going to pump them out, and so on. So they're coming over. So their thing was, let's bring out our own version, so at least they'll be reading our version rather than somebody else's. Yes?
I think this kind of segues into what you were saying earlier in this lecture. When the printing press was made to print Bibles, the printing press was also the beginning of the expansion of knowledge going everywhere, too, because now you had mass-produced books,
right,
where the common folk could read the scientific things and histories and things like that that only the super rich could afford, because they all had the handwritten.
All handwritten, absolutely.
So, I mean, the Bible itself, translating it from Latin to English into German, is what also brought the beginning of that increase of knowledge that you spoke of earlier.
Right.
I think it kind of segues together.
Right, but it's amazing to me how when you get, you know, that the original scholarship behind the King James Bible, and I'm not saying this because I'm German and my wife is German, because I was born in America and my people have been here for a long time, and she just came over on the boat, but it's true. Martin Luther worked with Tyndale, and he had to have a lot of influence with Tyndale, because they knocked out that New Testament in 1 year. So you got Luther, and then Tyndale. I mean, it's Tyndale, and then Coverdale finishes Tyndale's, and then Coverdale does the Great Bible, and then going into that Bible is all Coverdale coming forward, you know, and we come all the way up to the King James Bible. And they still, the authorities admit it's 80% Coverdale. This is not a new version. This is a revision of a revision. I heard that years ago, and I had no idea it was. One time I heard somebody say, the King James is a revision of a revision of a revision of a revision. So what are you talking about? No, they translated that out of the original Hebrew. No, they didn't. No, they did not. They did have Erasmus's Greek scriptures. They sure did. But they only consulted it. When they consulted the other translations, they said, boy, you can't improve upon this cover. This Tyndale, you know, has about as good as it gets. And especially like the rhythm and the rhyme and the meter, you know, how it flowed. Okay, then we have the Great Bible, but that was the first, you know, English authorized Bible. But Coverdale, who was a protege of Tyndale, he's the one who did that. Let's see. And Queen Mary, you know, Queen Mary's the one that said, you know, she used to like to burn people at the stake. She was a real witch. She liked to burn people at the stake. The religion in England, you know, went back and forth. The powers that be would either promote Catholicism or this Reformation that was beginning, you see. But understand, the Anglican Church, what they call the English Anglican Church, was never really Protestant. And they even brought out their versions to counter, as a counter against what they considered this Protestant Bible. You know, I guess the first real Protestant Bible would be the Geneva Bible that Calvin instituted, you know. But Catholicism was kind of stamped out there for a while. But Queen Mary came back, brought it back in. She started burning people, burning a lot of people at the stake, and she was criticized for it. And she said, I'm only doing, this is what she's reported to have said, she said, I'm only doing to these heretics what God is going to do to them for all eternity. I'm just doing it now. That's how she justified burning them at the stake. John Fox is down there. He wrote the famous Fox's Book of Martyrs. Then we come John Calvin. Everybody considers him such one of the greatest theologians of all time, but I think he's one of the most evil heretics that ever lived. Here we have John Knox, Calvin and John Knox. We got the Geneva Bible. One thing interesting about the Geneva Bible, and it really was a step forward, they were the first ones to number the scriptures, how in the world could you find your way? You notice how it says when Christ went in the synagogue, he said, and when he found the place, you had to find the place. You had to roll that scripture around, and find the place. You had to find the place by what it said before and after. Now we just, Matthew 3:16, or John 3:16, and you go to John, you go to 3, you go to 16. Boom, boom, boom. Right? It's great. So that was an improvement for sure. But notice again what it says there in the middle of that page, between 1560 and 1654, at least 144 editions of this Bible were published. Examination of 1611 King James shows clearly that its translators were influenced much more by the Geneva Bible than any other source. The Geneva Bible itself remains, however, 90% William Tyndale. So no matter what they were translating, nobody could improve upon Tyndale. The guy was apparently just totally honest, understood Greek, understood Latin, made a concerted effort to make a very accurate translation. But not only did he make a very accurate translation, he did it in this magical, rhythmic meter, that you have in the King James that you don't have in other Bibles unless they're copies of the King James. But it was not the King James. Let's give credit where credit's due. This is William Tyndale's work. Okay, let's do another thing or two here and we'll take a break. Okay, we got the Catholic then. The Catholics got into it. Remember, they're the ones that you can't make a copy of the scriptures in anything but Latin or you die the death, But everybody's got these English translators. They say, well, we might as well get on them too, because if all the people are going to read English, if we don't have an English Bible and they speak English, guess what they're going to read? They're going to read these Protestants' English Bibles. We better make an English Bible. So they made an English Bible, the Dowry, Reims Dowry. The first they did the Dowry, which was in the Reims, which was the New Testament, and then the Dowry was the Old Testament. And so now I got a copy. It's the Reims Dowry Catholic Bible. Okay, now we come to King James. We'll pick it up there. I think that's where we'll pick it up. The King James Bible after break. Okay, should we take a break?